13230035CV, Donna Independent School District versus Diana Quintanilla.
May I please court? Good morning. Today, Your Honor, or Your Honors, we're here on an appeal of a denial of motion for summary judgment triggering jurisdictional issues on behalf of my client, the Donna ISD. And so what I want to, I just want to go over kind of the quick issues that are at stake, give you a brief timeline of events that I think are relevant, and then brief our appellate points. I mean, obviously, we're well briefed, but we want to give you some additional information just to share with you today. So the three, this is a whistleblower claim, and so the nature of the challenge to jurisdiction is going to have to do with the timing of the filing versus the report of the violation of law. That's going to be really the crux of what we're talking about. But the three issues, number one, that the appellee failed to trigger a waiver of defendant's sovereign immunity for the alleged act of being placed on administrative leave. So the concept of being placed on administrative leave was the adverse action that we're going to be talking about today. The reason we're going to talk about that particular adverse action, because in the live pleading jurisdictionally in this case, it's an original petition, that's the only allegation of adverse action, which is that particular administrative leave on September 28, 2020. That's relevant and important, as I'll discuss with you, but that is the one that's in the live pleading, so that's what we're talking about. Secondly, we're going to argue that any potential termination claim that be raised or discussed in the appeal, it should be denied outright. And of course, that the plaintiff Quintanilla did not establish a necessary element of causation when it comes to the alleged whistleblower claim. And that has to do with a proximity argument, a proximal causation argument, which I will brief you. So the only action we're talking about today is a whistleblower cause of action. But back in December of 2016, Ms. Quintanilla filed a police report alleging a misappropriation of funds by an employee of the district named Maricela Valdez. That happened in 2016. That was the report of the violation of law in 2016. In January 2017, that employee that she reported on was placed on administrative leave and ultimately terminated. So that employee that she complained about was investigated and was ultimately terminated from employment. In November of 18, that same employee actually got, only in America, got elected to the Donna Board of Trustees. And so she served as a trustee subsequent to being an employee who had since been removed from the district based on that whistleblower report in 2016. Now, the relevant timeline after that is it was 19 months later after all that, on June 18th of 2020, when the superintendent advised the plaintiff that an investigation of some allegations into her unprofessional conduct was being substantiated. So you can imagine, we have a report, and then that was made by the plaintiff. The person she reported got terminated. 19 months later after that happened, this employee, this plaintiff is being investigated, and she was reprimanded. That's all that happened. She was then given a new contract of employment for the following year. So she's going to be reinstated. This is over 19 months after this report of violation to the police department. Now, 3 months later, on September 28th, she's placed on administrative leave due to another investigation regarding just conduct allegations with other employees. And so she's being investigated. On June 16th, 2021, she was advised that at the end of her contract term for 2021, which was June 28th of 2021, that we're not going to renew your contract after that. In other words, you're going to be allowed to work out the remainder of your contract for 1 year, and then that's the end of your employment at that point. So she was never actually terminated. She was allowed for the extent of her contract to expire. Now, 17 months after she was ever placed on administrative leave as alleged, that's when she filed her lawsuit. Now, the adverse action alleged in the live petition is that administrative leave on September 28th. And in the briefing, you'll see, I think it was very, very much clarified that there wasn't an amended petition that was ever actually filed. The live petition at issue jurisdictionally is the original petition. There was some requests from plaintiff regarding permission to seek an opportunity to amend it, but they never actually amended the complaint, so it never actually got filed. So the actual live petition is the original. In the briefing.
So counsel, should we remand to give Ms. Quintanilla an opportunity to replead?
No. And the reason, and I was going to address that, and the reason why that would be improper, Your Honor, is because the jurisdictional challenge is based on the facts that are before the court, which is the original petition. So when they denied the summary judgment on behalf of the defendant, there was no adverse relief given to the plaintiff. In other words, they suffered no adverse action. The motion was denied. So they have no appellate point, and they're not appellants in this particular cause of action. The only issue is whether or not the summary judgment should have been granted on the original petition. So to take it to its fruition, the remedy for them in that regard, if the court agrees with what we're proposing in our appeal here, is to deny the summary judgments, reverse that, That judgment denying that, they can challenge that on appeal afterwards if they believe there was error in that determination. But it can't be done in this appeal. They have no standing or jurisdiction to do that. They have nothing to appeal. There was a denial of the summary judgment on behalf of the defendants. Does that make sense?
It does, but I guess it's another remedy. I mean, granted, they have not counter-appealed, but wouldn't they have, or wouldn't one of the options we have was just to affirm?
If you affirmed, it'd be affirming that the original petition, which is the only one at issue,
right,
that had an adverse action of back in 2021, versus the time, see, they have 90 days after that adverse action to initiate a whistleblower claim, and the timeline is well beyond that. So in response to the summary judgment, they were arguing, well, you know, this is really more about when they got non-renewed, put the timeline up a little further out. But there's no live allegation in that regard, and even if you did that, even if you took that, the timeline is still too far. So, and perhaps if I go through maybe a couple of these other points for you here, I can maybe elaborate a little better and brief that issue.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay, go ahead.
One of the things I was looking at, if you look at the pleading, and I know mm-hmm. what you're talking about with regard to the September 2020 date, but there seems to be read different allegations within the opinion, like an underlying kind of indication of a continuous acts of retaliation during a longer period of time post 2020. Do you think that could be cleared up by an amendment of the current pleadings?
No, Your Honor. No, okay. I do not. And actually, we briefed that issue too. I think that was in issue 3 when we're talking about the proximal causation. If you look at our briefing in that regard, it'll address that issue. But I hesitate to say it's an unfortunate circumstance of the way it is procedurally, but quite frankly, the whistleblower law is very clear about its determinations about triggering a waiver of immunity. And because it wasn't triggered right, the only remedy that's available to the court is the only proper remedy available to the court is to reverse what happened at the trial court, because the only grounds the trial court could have used to deny the motion was to say that administrative leave that's in the original petition was proximately proper, and it wasn't. And that's what we're challenging here to discuss with you all. So if I go through, you know, in the 90-day deadline that comes out in the whistleblower statute, it's very simple. If administrative leave was on September 28th of 2020, the petition was filed in March 8th of 2022. So rather than 90 days, that's 562 days from the date of leave. So it's a really large window there. Secondly, if we're talking about a termination claim that raised at some point, but I think it was further briefed by appellee that they really weren't pursuing termination, but just because that issue kind of raised its head, I'll just make a comment that she was allowed to work throughout the term of her contract. There was no termination. The record's clear there's no termination here, and I think that's why in the appellee's brief it was kind of clarified in that regard. But for causation, the actual whistleblower report itself, that happened in December 22nd of 2016. The actual whistleblower, the first possible thing that happened to her that she could complain about was the administrative leave, and that happened on September 28th of 2020. That's 3 years and 9 months after that report.
But did she also file a grievance about being non-renewed?
Also further intemporal, because she wasn't non-renewed until after this administrative leave date of September 20th. The earliest date she could work with was the administrative leave, which was September 2020. And so if you go with the earliest date, we're still 3 years and 9 months after the report.
What about the latest date she could have done it?
It would have been even further from the report.
Okay.
In the case law that I've briefed some examples from Texas courts talking about this temporal proximity. And most of them, I'll give you some examples, like, you know, Texas Supreme Court 2018 says an 8-month gap, it is so long as to be of little, if any, probative value. That's Alamo Heights versus Clark. Then you've got one that says City of Fort Worth versus Zimlick, this is also Supreme Court, again in 2000, says 8 months later for a whistleblower claim, too far of a proximity. Well, we have, you know, over 3 years and 9 months in this particular allegation. So if we're looking at trying to tie in causation from the whistleblower complaint, because that's what it is, the whistleblower complaint to what happened to you, it's just way too large a gap. It's 3, 4, 5 times beyond what the courts have already said is not enough to trigger. So that's our third point in there.
I want to ask,
of course,
follow up on a question
that
the justice asked, and that is, if we view this as a course of conduct, the last act that could be determined to be an adverse employment action is the non-renewal of the contract. Is that correct?
They could take that position, and if it was pled in a live petition, it'd be an argument that we'd have to address. Yes, sir.
Okay, so if it was pled, is that within the time limitation that's proper when they filed the lawsuit?
No. That's even further beyond the date of the report. You see, when we're talking about a whistleblower claim, it's did my report of a violation of law trigger my adverse
problem? You're looking at them as single incidences and not a course of conduct. And that's the question I'm asking you. Is the final act the non-renewal of the contract? If we assume that is an adverse employment action, did they file the lawsuit within time?
No, sir. I believe it would still violate it would still be insufficient to accomplish the temporal proximity of the causation argument. Because if I go back to the earliest possible opportunity they could have, the very earliest one, they're still 3 years and 9 months off.
Now, that temporal proximity issue that you raise,
yes, sir,
that really is a fact question, is it not? I mean, you're saying that the presumption, I think one of the cases you just laid out said it has little value, but it has some probative value that a jury could determine, could it not?
At 8 months, but 3 years and 9 months, there's no case law support for that at all. It's just way too far. And you know, the case law, Your Honor, I should bring it up, actually says that when a person makes a report like that, it doesn't give them life tenure. In other words, where I made a report so I can no longer ever be disciplined or addressed in that regard.
And that's why we have juries, though. They determine fact questions.
Sure. But in this regard, the proximal distance is so far, I don't believe there is a fact issue, because if 8 months is enough to potentially eliminate it, three years and six is significantly larger. And then if we're talking about all that being said, the one thing I'll tie back to is, you know, the plaintiff can't seek to amend their petition here, not in the appellate court. And they can't seek to amend it after the record is clear, the record is sound. The live petition is the original petition. The only relief they have is regard to that original petition. So if they had filed an amended petition beforehand, we'd be talking about something totally different. There'd be in the record. You could put it up and we can address it, but it wasn't there. And so the only relief is to address the allegations in the original, which involve that administrative leave argument that is clearly barred under the Whistleblower Act. So it kind of leaves very little discretion, in my opinion, with respect to the appellate court as what to do. Now, post that, after that, assuming the court agrees with me what I'm saying and looks at the briefing and decides, look, that's right, the original petition says you're barred as a matter of law, it goes back to the trial court, they issue a judgment, they can file a motion for a new trial, they can file an appeal of that, they can challenge those issues, they can look at those at that time, but it can't be done in this appeal because they didn't suffer any adverse error at the appellate court, at the trial court level.
So you're saying that pleading retaliation in general is not sufficient for her to maintain a claim because it's not tied to a specific act within that 90-day period?
Yes, Your Honor. It wouldn't trigger a waiver of the sovereign immunity under the statute to allow her to sue the school district. That's correct. If you have no further questions this time, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Of course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm going to start off by talking about what I think is probably determinative in this case, which is just procedure. I think all of this can be resolved through a very simple procedural analysis. First thing, Dunn ISD, which is my hometown, by the way, they filed a motion for summary judgment in this case. They did not file a plea to the jurisdiction. And so the jurisprudence in Texas, based upon pleading defects in a motion for summary judgment, is different than what would be required in a plea to the jurisdiction. The analysis is different. And just so the court understands, I've represented municipal entities and in governmental entities in the past, and I don't, as a matter of practice, like to do a motion for summary judgment. I always do a plea to the jurisdiction because the biggest difference between the two is in a plea to the jurisdiction, if it's factually based, you can call live witnesses and you can submit any type of testimony at the time of the hearing. And that is a significant departure from a summary judgment procedure where you are barred from the rule. It's 166A says it in itself, you cannot present live evidence. And it's a it's a very, very different procedural mechanism. And here, the binding case law from the Texas Supreme Court says, only after a party has been given an opportunity to amend after special exceptions have been sustained. May the case be dismissed for failure to state a cause of action. Now, the entire appeal that appellant has asserted is based upon pleading defects, and they brought it based on summary judgment.
But Mr. Escobar, they didn't have to file special exceptions, did they?
Yes, Your Honor. The law specifically says if you're seeking to dismiss via summary judgment a claim based upon the pleading defects, then you must, it says, only after a party has been given an opportunity to amend, after special exceptions have been sustained, may the case be dismissed for failure to state a cause of action. This appeal is based upon whether or not the client states the prima facie cause of action for a whistleblower claim. That's what this is. And so if it was a plea to the jurisdiction, we may not be having this discussion, but it's not. It's a motion for summary judgment. And the longstanding case law says what I just said, and that's Massey versus Armco Steel Company, 652 Southwest 2nd, 932. That's Texas Supreme Court, 1983. And it specifically states in there as a policy reason, it says, the protective features of special exceptions should not be circumvented by a motion for summary judgment where the plaintiff's pleadings fail to state a cause of action. And so that's the first reason the court can affirm, is because there were no special exceptions filed. The special exceptions were not sustained, and an amended petition was not filed, the appellee was not provided with the opportunity after the special exception to file an amended petition. So we have all that procedural law.
Was there any docket conference control order or anything that prevented you from amending your petition?
Your Honor, the only thing that I'm aware of would be the 7-day rule prior to trial that they, you know, you have to file. Or
sure.
If you're going to amend, you got to do it because a motion for summary judgment hearing is tantamount to a trial on paper. And so the only rule that I would know about at the particular time that this was filed, Your Honor, would have been, I may be misspeaking, Your Honor, I don't know precisely, but I think that would be the only thing I'm aware of that would bar the appellee from having to do that. But, Your Honor, the other glaring thing is this, it's a very small part of my appellee's brief, but it's probably the biggest part. And so here's what it is. The affidavit that was submitted to anchor the entire motion for summary judgment was unverified and unsigned. And so the dates that they have to prove, well, how do they prove them? There's only one way you can prove what happened, who said what, and then when the termination was, when the grievance was. All that evidence, it's not my burden. It's Donna's burden. All that evidence has to come through an affidavit if you're using summary judgment practice. That affidavit was unsigned and it was unverified. And the black letter law says an unsigned document purporting to be an affidavit does not qualify as an affidavit and does not constitute competent evidence in determining a summary judgment issue. In the brief I cited, Nevada's versus Inland Services, 645 Southwest 3rd, 870. That's Texas Appeals El Paso, 2022. And so the date that he's trying to tell the court, hey, this happened at this time, and then she was here, and then it doesn't meet the timeline, and you can't establish any of those facts. There are no facts, because he filed a motion for summary judgment with no proof. Why? Because the affidavit is unsigned. And the case law says that the government code defines what an affidavit is. It is not evidence. In other words, he filed a motion for summary judgment with no evidence. That's what happened. Because he filed a traditional motion and a no evidence motion. But if you get rid of the affidavit, and we do as a matter of law, there's no way this court can say, there's no way anybody can say, there's nothing anybody can do to somehow magically put that signature on that affidavit at this point. So where's the proof when Danny Quintanilla was hired? You don't have it. Where's the proof where she was terminated? You don't have it. You don't have any proof. You have nothing. Because the only way he can submit the proof is through an affidavit that was unsigned. So everything goes away. He can't prove when she was terminated. He can't prove when she was hired. He can't prove when the retaliation. He can't prove anything. You have no motion for summary judgment. You're done. But even if we proceed with it, Your Honor, even if we assume that somehow this affidavit can come in and he has a shot to dismiss this case because of a no evidence point, you still don't have the ability to do that because, and it's important to look at, it's on page 43 of my brief, there's a timeline. And the timeline shows you under government code 55406, 05 and 06, the different timelines. And so here it's precisely what the court was talking about. We have a continuing course of conduct. And it does span a significant amount of time, but it's very explainable. And the reason that it's explainable is because of the way the facts went. Now, the circumstantial evidence case law that I've cited in the case, and I want to make sure that I spend the proper amount of time on it, because Mr. Garza has really emphasized it, the temporal proximity issue. And so with respect to that whole body of case law, that case law says when you have, the only evidence you have of retaliation is when the report occurs and when the person gets terminated or adversely affected. If you only have, the only evidence of retaliation is temporal proximity, well, that temporal proximity has to be very, very close. So those are the cases that Mr. Garza is citing. He's citing cases where you don't have any evidence of absolutely nothing else. All you have is when did the report to law enforcement occur and when did the adverse action occur. And the case law says if that's all the evidence you have, those two dates have to be close. That's what all the cases say. And it says that, one moment, I need to go through it right here. When the only evidence of alleged retaliation is temporal proximity between the report and the adverse action, there must be, the retaliation must be very close in time to establish causation between the events. And that's San Antonio versus Nicholas, 441 Southwest 3rd, 382, a San Antonio case, 2013. And In the case, one of the cases that I use, I think it's a pretty good example because it's similar to this case in a lot of ways. It's that Azubik versus Fiesta Mart. It's in my brief, 970 Southwest 2nd, 60 Houston of 1998. And in that case, we had an employee of Fiesta Mart, and he made two reports about illegal conduct that was ongoing at his employment. He made the first one in November 10th of 1989, and then he made a second report letter talking about illegal conduct at the employment on May 14th of 1992. His termination was December 16th of 1994, okay? And so the court was looking at it, and they say pretty much what the other San Antonio case I just said. It said the court held, such a lapse of time with nothing more is too long to establish that there was a causal connection between the letters and Fiesta's decision to terminate his employment. And so all the cases that Mr. Garza is looking at are, it's kind of in a vacuum, Your Honor. There are only cases where the only evidence you have are those two dates. So they have to be real close. And he's saying here is that, well, apply that same logic to this case because there's a very long time between when the report occurred and when the termination occurred. But here, this is what you had, Your Honor, and it takes a while, but I think it's very important that we go through it. On December 22nd, 2016, Diana Quintanilla files the report. In January of 2017, which is just a month later, Maricela Valdez was placed on administrative leave. But in the letter that they sent to her, telling her that she's on administrative leave, the letter itself says, we're putting you on leave because Diana Quintanilla has informed us that you were misallocating $3 million. of federally earmarked funds and putting it in another account. The letter itself tells her who the person was that created the very first adverse action upon her employment. Subsequently, which is about, you know, 10 months later, 8 months later, in October of 2017, Maricela Valdez, she was fired by Donna ISD for the same things, the investigation based upon what Ms. Quintanilla had reported. Then in November of 2018, this is more than a year later, after she was terminated, Mrs. Valdez was elected to the Donna School Board. Now, in around, I believe, it's a little bit more than 18 months to 2 years, is when different allegations of misconduct against Diana Quintanilla started to occur. And the record shows that the nephew of Maricela Valdez was the one who was making these allegations against her. Now, obviously, if this is not a jury trial, Your Honor, but, you know, we could make good hay about that because it seems more than a coincidence, but it's circumstantial evidence, I would argue, nonetheless. In August of that same year, 2020, she filed a grievance against her misconduct. Then in August of 2020, Maricela Valdez, she assumes the position of president of the school board. Okay, and then once she becomes president of the school board, this is when Diana Quintanilla started getting information from coworkers that says, "Hey, now that Ms. Valdez is the," and it's in there. Clerk's Record 106. That's where the testimony is, where Diana Quintanilla says, she quotes the different people that are calling her, and they say, "Now that Maricela Valdez is president, she's going to get you out." Those were their words, not mine. Again, that's on Clerk's Record 106. And now, so—
Counsel, I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I hate to take you from your stream of thought, but it's a question I'd like you to answer.
Yes.
It's been alleged that your live pleadings are insufficient. Can you point to language in your live pleadings that give this court jurisdiction?
Your Honor—
taking a liberal perspective, is there language in there that broadly gives us jurisdiction?
I believe so, because it does indicate some course of continuing conduct that begat the retaliatory action, which was her non-renewal in June of 2021. Okay. I mean, she does identify the September date, but again, in the motion for summary judgment response, she does two things that are critical, Your Honor. Number one, she fesses up to the pleading errors. But number two, which is it's entirely appropriate under the law for her to ask the court for leave to amend after the time that the court, or during the time that the court rules on the motion. And so what I'm saying is, number one, yes, I believe that the allegations in the petition are—
I'm looking for some specific language. Is there language you can point to that can assist us that gives the court jurisdiction? Even if it's something as broad as retaliation or discrimination, that's what I'm looking for.
Well, Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have the petition with me to tell you verbatim what it would be, but my understanding is the allegations of the whistleblower claim are based on broad terms, meaning that there was a course of conduct. I don't believe, Your Honor, that it's just based on one act. There is some language that identifies the September date that Mr. Garza is talking about. There's no question that it says that. But in the broader terms, I believe if it's not in the prayer for relief or at the beginning of the facts in the case, they talk about the different conduct that she was subjected to over the course of some time that led to her termination. So in that respect, I would argue that it does, Your Honor, taking a liberal approach. But really, and I want to go back to my first argument, we never get there. And I don't think this is just because this motion for summary judgment is fatally defective from the beginning. There's no way that the court can overturn what the trial court did because, again, there is no affidavit that establishes anything. This motion for summary judgment is nothing. It's nothing because there is no facts to say when she was hired, when she was retaliated against, when she made a report, when she was not renewed. There's no facts that he's established as a matter of law so that you could grant him judgment. So it's gone. The only thing he is arguing at this point, what he would be relegated to, would be a no evidence point. But the standard for no evidence points, as opposed to a traditional, are different. You only have to point to where the evidence is in the record. And I have done an exhaustive identification of every single one of those issues and every single way that she is able to establish what the whistleblower claim is. I mean, I went through the record, the evidence is in there about when she was hired, how she was hired, her ascension to her position, the report to the police department, the whole thing. And again, I'm gonna refer to table one in my brief, it's on page 43, and it outlines the specific dates on when it was that she made the complaints, how she grieved it, level one, level two, level three, all the way to the school board, and then within a month of the time that the school board considered the grievance, she filed her suit. And so under 554.06 and 05, it's within 90 days of the time that she began the grievance process. And so it is acceptable under the law. She met her deadlines. But, Your Honor, yes, I believe that to address your point, that there would enough language in the petition itself to grant jurisdiction to the court. And in the alternative, like I said, I don't even think we're here on a very crippled motion for summary judgment. It's not, there's nothing that he can identify in there that is able to substantiate any of the facts that he is required to establish in order to get summary judgment in the first place. And so I just feel that because the law allows Ms. Quintanilla to amend her petition, and the law allows this court to say, look, if you don't think there's enough jurisdictional facts, but those jurisdictional facts are curable by amendment, then the thing that the court should do, in our humble opinion, is to remand it, allow her to flesh out all the facts. We can plead them, maybe as specifically as I've done in this particular appellate brief, but those facts are there. And it does represent a continuing course of conduct where Ms. Valdez, the person that we are alleging is the ringleader of this adverse action to Ms. Quintanilla, I mean, she worked there as the CFO, and when she was suspended, she was sent a letter that says, look, you can't come to the campus anymore, you can't do anything, and that lasted months. And then she got terminated, and so a whole year and change had passed, and she wasn't even had anything to do with Donna Independent School District. But when she came back as on the school board, and then when she ascended to the position of the president, that's when you start seeing in the facts where Diana Quintanilla was being called and she was being harassed, and the people were saying, why are all these administrators coming to us and asking us questions about you? They're asking, do you have any complaints about it? All that is fleshed out in the appellate brief, but it shows that this wasn't something that occurred from one day to the next. And it puts this case outside of all the cases Mr. Garza cited, because you do not have just evidence of the temporal proximity argument that he relies so much upon. It's much more than that. We have a lot more facts than just the temporal proximity facts. And so I see that I'm out of time. And so, Your Honor, appellee requests that you affirm the trial court's judgment denying the motion for summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Garza, you're going to have 7 minutes and 16 seconds because you have reserved the time. So.
May I please court?
Yes.
I think one of the most challenging things about being an attorney is fighting the resisting the ability to stand up and interrupt when you hear things that you have a difference of opinion on. And that's some of the items I'd like to just go through and just clarify a couple things. The first one I want to talk about is the concept of using a summary judgment, be it a traditional or no evidence, with respect to challenges to jurisdiction. That I learned in this court. because I filed pleas to jurisdictions on many occasions over different government entities, and in an opinion authored by this court indicated, you know what, the proper vehicle when you're going to be addressing evidence or challenging a lack of evidence to establish jurisdiction is a motion for summary judgment. I want to say that might have even been authored by Justice Longoria, but I'm not sure about that fact, but I do know that I learned that procedure. So that's why we chose that procedural vehicle, because the courts are very clear you can challenge jurisdiction at any times, and it's best to challenge it up front before all the expense of litigation incurred. So that was a proper challenge, of course. With respect to challenges of evidence that were before the court's record, I'd recommend the court go back and see what challenges were accepted, which ones were denied, and what, because there's more than one exhibit attached to our traditional motion for summary judgment. But the no evidence motion for summary judgment is also relevant because it's not our burden to trigger jurisdiction against us, how to sue the district. It's the plaintiff's burden to do that. And so that stems from originally, which was the concept about special exceptions. Okay, it's, you know, the plaintiff's argument fails to recognize a very, very common theory in law, but in peak equipment, Peak versus Equipment Services, this is a Texas Supreme Court opinion. We briefed it. It's a 1989 opinion. Essentially, when the plaintiff's petition affirmatively demonstrates that the recovery is barred, there's no opportunity or need to actually amend. See, we didn't write the plaintiff's petition. We don't have to tell them how to sue us or what we need to do. They filed a whistleblower cause of action. If it was a pleading defect, we'd say, you can't sue us for a whistleblower cause of action. That's a pleading defector. If you sued a school district for a slip and fall, you can't sue us for a slip and fall. It's barred under the Tort Claims Act. That would be a pleading defect. But when you plead a cause of action like the whistleblower claim, we can't say that's a defect. It is a whistleblower claim. You can sue us for the whistleblower act, but you have to have facts that establish that particular cause of action. The facts they chose to rely upon within the original petition do not trigger jurisdiction. We have no obligation to tell them, hey, you need to do this and this so you can sue us properly. You need to go find another way to trigger jurisdiction against us. We don't have to do that. That's why special exceptions were not appropriate in this regard. Now, in addition, oh, by the way, another fact I think that was relevant in discussing, because the record is replete with evidence on these jurisdictional issues, but the plaintiff, Ms. Quintanilla, was actually offered and accepted one-year employment contracts in 2017, 2018, 2019, and 2020. The report that she made to the police department was back in 2016.
Is it relevant to us, Mr. Garza, that she, the person that's supposedly retaliating against the plaintiff here, had no power to do anything to her through those years when her contracts were renewed?
She voted to approve those contracts.
Was she not? She wasn't on the
school? She was a board member. So subsequently, when she got elected, she never voted against the contract. We're talking about certain facts that are interrupting the causal connection between retaliation that happened years ago and what's going on today. It's not the most crucial fact in the world, but I think it's worth mentioning, you know, because she was literally on the Board of Trustees when all those contracts were offered and accepted. And it's not why I think this the trial court's ruling should be reversed. It's really not, but it's a real fact. The reason I think the trial court's ruling has to be reversed is because you asked a question, Your Honor, about the original petition. The only adverse action alleged in the original petition is that administrative leave. You'll see that. We briefed that, biggest life, making noise about it because it's a fact.
Did they not use the term discrimination or harassment or?
Well, with respect to their whistleblower claim, they're obligated to file what their adverse action was, and the only adverse action articulated was that. Now, subsequent, you heard in the response to the summary judgment, they started bringing up other potential adverse actions, and they had an opportunity to replead that, but they did not. So there is no subsequent petition with that. So we're stuck, whether we like it or not, with the original petition, which is the one at issue, and under that petition, it doesn't trigger jurisdiction of the Whistleblower Act, so the summary judgment has to be denied. It has to be granted, I'm sorry. And the trial court has to be reversed. There simply is no jurisdiction. So it's not. While it is a matter of procedure, it's also a matter of the contents of the actual pleading at issue. Now, if there was an adverse ruling against them at the trial court, right, then they could have challenged or raised other issues here on appeal that may have been more relevant. Like perhaps if the court had denied the summary judgment, they could have taken it up on appeal immediately here too. And in that regard, they could have said, we should be given an opportunity to appeal, they could at least make those arguments because they've suffered an adverse action at the trial court level. But they didn't suffer an adverse action. The only one that suffered adverse action at the trial court level was us because we got our motion denied. So the only appellate issues before the court are whether or not the original petition triggers jurisdiction under the Whistleblower Act to allow the suit to even go forward. And I am confident in representing to you that through the entirety of the briefings, the entirety of the record, the jurisdiction just isn't there. So we're asking this court to reverse the ruling, reverse and render the ruling of the trial court, instructing them that there's no jurisdiction. For that reason, the case must be dismissed. And then if the appellee wants to challenge those issues using post-judgment methods that would be applicable to the appellee procedurally, then they can do that. But at this level here, it would be improper to affirm what happened at the trial court. So with that, I appreciate the time and patience. I know these are some, it's a unique issue. I'll grant you that. We do this kind of work all the time, and some of these things are, but the record is what the record is. And the live petition is what the live petition is, and jurisdiction is not a question of fact. It's just essentially, it's either there or it's not. And in this situation, it's not. So I thank you for your time and attention, and I look forward to reading your ruling as it comes forward.
Thank Mr. you Garza, both. I have one question. I'm sorry. How do you respond to Mr. Escobar's argument regarding the unverified affidavit?
Patiently and slowly, Your Honor, and most of my regards. Now, you know, that's one of actually multiple exhibits that were attached to our motion for summary judgment. And so it's not fatal to the other evidentiary. You kind of heard some references to other evidentiary issues that were briefed and responded to the brief because it's part of the record. Judge did not strike exhibits. Judge did not grant any particular objection and say something is going to be rejected. So technically, that affidavit's part of the record because it was never stricken. But on the side issue of that one, using the no evidence portion of 166A, okay, that's a very powerful motion because what it does, it essentially says, look, we've challenged the concept of jurisdiction here, and it is now your burden to put forth evidence, to offer evidence, identify evidence that triggers jurisdiction. That wasn't done. So even if we hadn't filed a traditional motion for summary judgment, there's no evidence triggering jurisdiction. And that particular vehicle, like I mentioned earlier, this 13th Court of Appeals itself here in Edinburgh has rendered opinion saying that is the proper course when you're challenging the lack of evidence to support a jurisdictional argument. So in both regards, I think the argument's fatal because one, it wasn't really stricken. There's no record of that, right? All you have is a denial of the summary judgment. Secondly, there's no record that exhibits were not being considered. And third, that's not the only exhibit that's attached establishing the record. But if we look at the petition, which is the driving force to triggering jurisdiction in any lawsuit whatsoever, regardless of evidence. We look at the petition itself doesn't trigger jurisdiction because it's barred by statute of limitations. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you both. This case will be under submission.